I looked. You may not be able to hear me. Thank you. I'm here. My name is Connie Mack. Grateful member of Alma. Love you too. I'm here to introduce Bo, a keynote speaker. Someone I fell in love with about 5 or 6 years ago. And before you walk out that door, you're going to be in love with him too. So I'd like to introduce my friend, Bo.
Thank you, Don. I love you. Are you ready? Hi, I'm an Al-Anon from Alabama, and my name's Bo Templin. Hey, y'all. I'm going to do my dead level best to not talk too fast tonight. I just hope y'all will be able to keep up with me. Dadgummit, I ain't finished the Lord's Prayer since I've been here. But I also need to let you know that I've got a wife at home named Shirley. She's fully aware of this love affair that Connie and I have going on. So, Carl, you can put your telephone up. There ain't no need in calling Shirley before this meeting's over. She knows about it. I'm glad to be here. And I'm glad you're here. Because let me tell you something. I love the parties. I love the parties. You'll find out as I share my story with you tonight that I was introduced to this way of life Labor Day weekend, 1982, at the party. Yeah, we picked up my wife at a treatment center at 12 noon on Saturday, Labor Day weekend. And about 4 hours later, we was about 100 miles south of Birmingham in a place called Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Home of the University of Alabama. Yeah, Roll Tide. And it was for the Tuscaloosa Al-Anon AA anniversary. We didn't know what that was. We was just told we was going to be there. And we walked into a big hall on that campus that night, and there was 500 of y'all. Cleaned up, dressed up. Foo-foo juice on, running around that place, hugging, laughing, and we fell in love with you right then. Fell in love with you that night. We didn't know what you had. We didn't know what you was about, and we didn't know what you had. All we knew was that it was infinitely better than what we brought to the table. And we left there that night with a burning desire that's still alive in our family today, because we've been with you ever since. So I love the parties, and I thank you. I thank the committee for inviting me back up here to this party. I've been to this party before, and I knew when four came up here that I was in for a good party. And I love the celebration. And if you're new here tonight, I hope that before you leave here this weekend, you have that feeling that you have been in a celebration of recovery. Because that's what this is about this weekend. Celebrating our recovery. Now let me tell you, you'll see me kind of leaning on the podium and turning strange ways tonight. And I don't know what all I'll do. 6 weeks ago, I had some real, real invasive surgery on my back. And one of the after effects of it was I came out of there with a numbness in my left leg and my left foot. That's going to go away. He assures me that it's going to go away. He just can't give me the timetable. And I've got a big old brace They're just absolutely, I hate it. And I made the decision this afternoon that I was going to go up to my room and I was going to rest a little bit and see if I could get this back in shape where I could make it through this thing tonight without having to wear that brace. And so far, I think we're going to make it. I think we're going to do all right. But the feeling, I've got about 75% of that feeling back into that left leg and left foot. But it started, see, and it's working its way down. That's the way it's coming back. And so I'm about two-thirds of the way down the shin. And part of my heel has got its feeling back. But the rest of it, it's just still out there. And every once in a while, my toes will go to tingling. And when they do, I'll just start pumping that leg. So I don't know. If you see me doing all that stuff, just say, hey, he's, you know, catch him next time. Maybe his back will be better. This has been an experience. But I told that doctor when we was kicking this around, I said, you know, he was telling me you need to do this surgery. Your back's not going to get any better until we do the surgery. This was the 1st of February, first week of February. So I told the doc, I said, Doc, I got to be in Connecticut first weekend of April. He said, we better get the scalpel out. And so we went ahead and we got that thing done. But now let me tell you the good news. The day before I went in that hospital, the pain was as bad as it's ever been in my back. And the day after the operation, I got up out of bed and walked down the hall and the pain was gone. Yeah. And that pain ain't been back. Now, I've been sore from a big old backhoe he used on my spine. But the pain's gone. And you see, the beautiful part about that is I knew that that pain was going to be gone because I had a worldwide full of folks that was praying for this thing to work. And I believe in the power of prayer. And I believe in spiritual healing. And I believe that God gave me that neurosurgeon. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. So anyhow, that kind of brings you up to where I am today so we can get on with this thing. I got two or three thank yous that I want to get out of the way right quick because I got about 3 or 4 hours of stuff I need to talk about here. And I can't talk that fast. But I thank the committee. Now, you just don't know from the bottom of my heart, I thank you for inviting me back up here. I needed to be here with you this weekend. In my life, everything that's going on, I needed to be right here with you this weekend. And thank you for allowing me to be a part of this thing. I want to thank the tapers. You know, these tapers do a lot of work. And a lot of times, we don't realize just how hard they work. See, we're here partying and they're out there working. And my goodness gracious, what a great way to carry the message is to do it with cassette tape. And I want to thank the tapers for being here and for doing the job they do. Now, let me tell you, there's another reason that I want to thank the tapers, and we're going to go into that right quick. he reminded me I was going to get free tapes. I'm sponsored by Old Timers. And I'll mention that several times tonight, and when I mention it, I'll tell you one more way that you can tell if your sponsor is an old-timer. So I'm sponsored by old-timers, and one of the ways that my sponsors keep controlling me is, you see, my sponsors know that I have an ego. Now, all you AAs in the room, that may come as a surprise to you. But we Al-Anons have egos, too. And my sponsors know that I've got that out-of-town talk, that I ain't had nerve to give it yet. But it's back there, you know, and one day, you just don't ever know. So one of the ways that my sponsors keep track of me is that I never know when I get back home when they're going to say, bring me that talk. They know that everywhere we go and we talk that we get a copy of our talk. And so I get back home next week, and I check in with my sponsors. They're liable to say, you know, hey, it's about time we listen to a talk. Drop that tape by. And I'd been out one weekend, and I'd been on one of these deals and had a great time. And I got back home and called, and Jim and Fran said, well, you know, we hadn't listened to your talk lately. Why don't you bring that talk by this afternoon? Let's drink a cup of coffee. And I behaved myself. It wasn't no problem, you know, so I went trucking by their house. And we got in there at the kitchen table, and we had the coffee pot, and we had the tape player, and we plugged the tape in. Now, I got to tell you, it wasn't Glenn. It wasn't these people. It was totally somewhere else. And they got me introduced, and I walked up there to the podium, and just about the time I started to introduce myself, there was this loud hum started in that tape. And it just drowned me out. And we ran it for a few minutes, you know, and it just kept going. You couldn't hear anything I was saying. And finally I looked at Jim and I said, man, there must be something wrong with his equipment. And Jim's sitting there just laughing. I said, what are you laughing about? He said, there ain't nothing wrong with his equipment, Bo. You didn't thank the taper. So thank you for being here. Let me get real serious just a minute. If you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're sitting in this room with us tonight, and from the bottom of my heart, I want to say thank you. I want to say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to say thank you for a couple of reasons. Number one, I want to thank you for being there 19 and a half years ago when my gal reached out her hand. Because, you see, I'd lost her. The bottle had her, and I couldn't do anything about it. And I was driving myself crazy trying to find a way to get her sober and keep her sober. And you know I couldn't find that. That button wasn't there. In late July 1982, when she had that moment of clarity that I believe all recovering people have, and she reached out her hand to AA, you had the hand of AA there for her. And you took her arm, you took her in, and you put your arms around her, and you loved her back to health. Because, you see, my wife was dying of a fatal disease that we didn't even know she had. And I'm convinced today that if she had not found that help in Alcoholics Anonymous, she would be dead. But you were there, and you put your arms around her, and you loved her back to health, and she didn't have to die. And, God, for that I'll be eternally grateful to you. And if she'll behave herself till the 30th day of this month, we're going to celebrate anniversary number 38. Yeah. And when she walked into your rooms and into your arms, she was dying. And we didn't even know it. I want to thank you for another reason. I want to thank you for knowing from the very beginning that alcoholism is a family disease. Now, you see, I know that you knew it from the very beginning because I'm one of those Al-Anons that's been raised in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't apologize or back up from that anywhere. That's another way you can tell if you're sponsored by old-timers. And it's right there in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous that I learned that you knew from the beginning because the 8th and 9th chapters are written to us. And I thank you for knowing that, and I thank you for including us from the beginning, because you see, once again, being sponsored by old-timers, I've been taught the history of our fellowships. And I know that the very first meetings were family meetings. The whole family was included. And I thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for having that 12-step program there and ready for us some 16 years after you got here when it was time for us to be born. And we walked in and we said, can we have your 12 steps? And you threw your arms open and said, come on in here, Bo. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to take our 12 spiritual principles and learn how to implement them in your life. And we want you to learn how to live happy, joyous, and free. And not be dependent on what another person does or does not do. And for that, I will be eternally grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, AA. When I introduce myself as an Al-Anon. I'd like to talk about that for just a moment. Because, see, when I got here Labor Day weekend 1982, I thought being married to that alcoholic made me an Al-Anon. What I've realized over the last 19 and a half years is that being married to her qualifies me for Al-Anon. It doesn't make me an Al-Anon. And there are several things that I do in my life today on a real regular basis in order to tell you that I'm a member of Al-Anon. And I want to talk about two or three of those right quick. The very first thing I do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I suit up and show up and occupy a chair in Al-Anon meetings on a real regular basis. A real regular basis. Now, I know that there's more to suiting up and showing up and occupying the chair. I know that this is a program of action. I know you can't get it by osmosis because I tried. The first 7 months that I was around this thing, I tried to rub up against you and let your recovery rub off on me. But it just wouldn't work. Let me explain it to you another way. I can take this chair right here, and I can take it out to the back of the lot, and I can put it in the middle of that chicken coop. That's what we call them down in Alabama. I can set it in the middle of that chicken coop, and I can occupy that chair in the middle of that chicken coop every day for 20 years, suiting up and showing up and occupying the chair. And guess what? I still won't be a chicken, will I? But let me suggest this to you, and listen to me closely. If I do that every day for 20 years, at the end of that time, I'm going to know a whole lot about chickens. And I'm going to know a whole lot about how the successful chickens are getting it done. Do you hear what I'm saying? Yes, I've got to take some action, but it starts with suiting up and showing up and occupying that chair. Being around you winners that were there for me when I got there. And watching what you're doing. And I begin to get an idea of the changes that I'm going to have to make in my life if I want to be like you when I grow up. So it begins with suiting up and showing up and occupying that chair. Okay? Going to meetings. The next thing I do in order to tell you that I'm an Al-Anon, and this is just what has worked for me, is I have to have a home group. Now, when I got here, I didn't need a home group. I got here, I didn't need Al-Anon. See, I got here well. There's nothing wrong with me. And if she didn't drink anymore, we was going to be okay. Yeah. And I believed that with all of my being and had a big old grin on my face when I told you about how she wasn't drinking no more. Yeah. And so I heard a couple of things up there at that treatment center that she went through. One of the things I heard was, those that stay sober are the ones that go to AA. And in an instant, my job in life changed. I now became the driver, and that's the way my wife introduces me today. Of course, she adds a little to it. She says, he drove me to drinking. He drove me to treatment. Now he drives me to AA. But in a flash, my job in life changed, you see. Because if she didn't drink, we were going to be okay. The next thing I heard up there that made an impression on me was they talked about 90 meetings in 90 days. So we got her out of treatment, and we started on that 90 meetings in 90 days. Now, we was going to meetings over here and over yonder and over there, just hitting in a little bit of everywhere, wasn't settling down nowhere. And all of a sudden, we began to go to a lot of meetings there in Bessemer, Alabama, which was to become our home group. We didn't know that at the time. And the night came that we showed up at Bessemer doing this 90 meetings in 90 days. Let me tell you, you should have seen us. We'd sit right down there on the front row because we had been told newcomers ought to sit down front. And I'd sit right there beside her, and that speaker would say something important, and I'd pop her with that elbow. Yeah. Man, I was paying attention, taking mental notes. Because I knew she was going to have some questions when we got home. She's still a little bit foggy, you see. And I knew I was going to have to be answering them questions. And we just rocking along there, and we're taking care of her recovery, and things are going good, and We show up there at Bessemer, and two of them AAs met me at the door, and I found out about tunnel vision in Alcoholics Anonymous. And AA's got some real tunnel vision about a couple of little, two or three little areas. And the area I found out about that night was closed meetings. Because we had strolled in, and it was a closed meeting, and they met me at the door and told me, said, Bo, you can't sit in this meeting tonight. This is for alcoholics only. I said, well, you don't understand. I've got, my job. And they said, no. We'll take care of Shirley. You leave her in here. And there's a meeting over there in that room that you've been needing to go to for a while. And they not so gently nudged me toward the door to the Al-Anon room. And I walked over there that night. And I walked up to that door. And at the Bessemer group, when you walk in the Al-Anon room, you're in the back of the room. The podium's way down at the front. You come in at the back. And I stopped there at the door, and it was 2 minutes to eight. Because, see, I was still in the ism. And the ism being I was sponsoring myself. And that's what ISM stands for. See, when I got those old-time sponsors, I was taught that you get there 30 minutes early, prepared to stay till it's over. See, my sponsors have taught me that there's no such thing as a one-hour meeting. A lot of meetings end in an hour. But you get there 30 minutes early, prepared to stay till it's over. Well, I wasn't there yet. I didn't have them yet. So it's 2 minutes to eight, and I walked over to that door and looked in that room, and there's 23 women in there. One other guy. He's way down front. So I went down there and got a seat by him, and when we sat through the meeting there, and I can tell you a little bit about that meeting, but not a whole lot. And anyhow, the meeting's over, and said the Lord's Prayer, and he turned, stuck out his hands, and he introduced himself, and I said, Kirby, now show him glad there's at least one other guy here. He said, oh, Bo, he said, I'm moving to Florida in the morning. He said, I'm going to turn him over to you, boy. And that wasn't nothing in the world but God taking care of me. Because, see, it took all 23 of them for me. If Kirby was still there and had a problem, I don't know what we'd have done. So I'm there, and I told those women. I told them that night when that meeting was over. I said, I don't need Al-Anon. I said, I'm only here to make sure that she's over there. And there's nothing wrong with me. And this probably is pretty good for those that need it, but I don't need it. And those gals begin to very gently put their arms around me and begin to use hooks that I didn't even know. And begin to pull me into this thing. And thank God they knew how to do that. Thank God. Let me tell you about the first hook they used with me. It's a hook called laughter. That first meeting that night was full of laughter. I love the laughter. Think back to when you first got here, just how important the laughter was. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that first meeting we had that night, we had one of our, she's a seasoned veteran. They won't let me call them old timers. But she was a seasoned veteran, and she was telling her story that night. So they opened the meeting and they introduced her, and she walked up front of the room to the podium, and she got up there and she says, hi, my name's Doris, and it's been 14 years since I had to plan a murder. Yeah. And that whole room erupted in laughter. Everybody except me. I didn't open my mouth, but in my mind I said, no, buddy, I wouldn't have said that. You never get me to admit that out loud. Because, see, I was just like a bunch of you in this room. I was planning that murder, too. I was going to kill her and tell God she died. But Doris just kept on throwing them things out there, and everybody kept laughing. And before that meeting was over that night, I realized that nobody was laughing at her. Everybody was laughing with her. And I love the laughter. That's one of the first hooks they used. Next hook that they started using on me, and they started it that very first night, was something called hugs. Down south, we hug. I know y'all hug up here, too. I'm a believer in them hugs. And down there, boy, you get a hug when you get there, and you get a hug when you leave. And if you're in the middle of a meeting and you're hurting a little bit and you need a hug, by golly, you get one in the middle of a meeting. It's all right. And here's what them gals would do. See, I'd already told them I wasn't supposed to be there. Didn't belong there. Didn't want to come. Now, this is true. They took a chair and put it right inside that back door. And they said, Bo, this is as far as you have to come in this room. This will be designated Bo's chair, and on the nights you're here, nobody can sit in this chair but you. And I did that for a long time. I'd come in there and I'd sit right inside that door. And I didn't know what they was doing. I realized it later. They was assigning a woman to me on a monthly basis. We believe in rotation. And so I had a new gal every month. And her job was that while we was holding hands, closing the meeting, she'd slip out of the circle and get between me and the door. Because she's going to intercept me and give me that going home hug. Because I'd try to get out the door because I didn't want to hug you, you see. So here's the way we'd do it. Now, the way we close our meetings down home, it seems like pretty much the way you close them up here. We stand and we hold hands and we say the Lord's Prayer. Now, being sponsored by old-timers, I've been taught that the Lord's Prayer ends with the word Amen. Consequently, we don't say anything after the word Amen. When we close and we say Amen, we drop hands and the meeting is over. And we don't say anything else. So we'd stand up that night and I'd close my eyes and I'd say the Lord's Prayer. I'd drop hands and turn for the door and there she'd be. And as I was going out the door, she'd stop me and she'd give me that hug and she'd whisper those words. She'd say, you keep coming back, Bo, because we need you. God, if you needed me. I mean, I was going to be coming anyhow. I had to bring her. But I'd been reading some of your literature, too, and I didn't tell you about that. And I'd begin to see some of the handwriting on the wall. And you see, folks, what I'm talking about here is the hooks that kept me coming till my miracle happened. Till my miracle happened. You know, next hook, this is the final one I'll talk about, is one they started with me that night and they still use today, and it's something called unconditional love. Those gals started giving to me that night so freely it was just absolutely mind-boggling. It took a long time before I could even get a little bit of an understanding about unconditional love. And then I got such an understanding that I became totally confused about unconditional love. And so I set out, this is just 4 or 5 years ago, I set out on this venture to learn more about unconditional love. Because, see, my concern, and I think the concern was valid at that time because I didn't understand. My concern was I have become a pro at receiving unconditional love. I am one of the absolute best in the world at taking your unconditional love. But am I doing a good enough job in giving back the unconditional love? And is there something I can learn to do better or in a different way that will make me more proficient in giving away the unconditional love? And I began to talk to old-timers. That's where I try to get all the information I can. It's from the old-timers. I'd go off to one of these conventions, and there'd be an old-timer there, like like a seasoned veteran, like our Sunday morning speaker. And I'd just get right up there with Vinoy all weekend, and I'd ask her questions, and we'd talk, because that's where my information comes from. And I just wasn't getting too comfortable with it. And a couple of years ago, I'm out there in San Diego, and at one of these things, and there's an AA speaker on Friday night, and he's up there talking, and I'm going to tell you something. This was a spiritual man. He has a relationship with God. No doubt in my mind. And he's up there talking, and I'm into this thing of listening to him about his relationship with God. And he starts talking about being a channel for God's love. He said, my biggest job today is to stay in tune with God. He said, as long as I keep this relationship okay and I'm a channel for God, then God can love you through me. He said, and if you'll work on your relationship with God and stay in tune with your spiritual principles, then God will be able to love me through you. I said, dummy, you've been reading the books and asking the questions and chasing the wrong rainbow. God is the one that's totally capable of unconditional love. You don't have to worry about being better or being perfect or anything else with unconditional love. All you got to do is work on staying spiritually fit where God can use you as a channel, and then you'll see unconditional love. And that's where I am today with unconditional love. And it all started in a little room there in Bessemer, Alabama in 1982. And I didn't even want it, didn't need it. The only reason I came there was for y'all to tell me how to keep her sober. Yeah. Man, what I have received as a result of showing up here. So, I hung around there till my miracle happened, and then Bessemer became my home group. The next thing I do in order to tell you that I'm an Al-Anon is I have sponsors. Now, let me tell you, Jay, just a little bit, and page two of that is that I sponsor people. So, I'm part of that process of carrying that message and of passing on what has been so freely given to us. Now, I'm one of those crazy ones out there. I've got, when it was time for me to get a sponsor, 7 months into this thing, when I was about as sick as I could stand to be, and I decided to get a sponsor, there were no male Al-Anons for me to look to, not in my area. And so I went to a lady, and I asked her if she would be my sponsor. And if she was here with you tonight with her arm around me, she would say, and I had a temporary lapse of a sanity greed. But let me tell you about my gal friend. She's old enough to be my mama. And sometimes she treats me like her son. She's a retired school principal. And there's a disciplinarian side to her that I didn't know existed till I invited her into my life. Now, she believes in service. She's a past delegate, and she has raised me in believing in service. She put a condition on it that night. She said, Bo, I'll be glad to sponsor you, but there's one condition. She said, I'll sponsor you the only way I know how. And I said, what does that mean? She said, I'll sponsor you in the steps, because that's the way I was sponsored, and it's the only way I know to sponsor. And if you're willing tonight, son, to make a conscious commitment to me that you want to take these 12 spiritual principles and implement them in your life, then I'm ready to take you by the hand and walk with you. That was 19 years ago. And she still does that today. Wasn't about 45 days into this thing, we knew that I needed to talk to a man. So she sent me out there in the AA room, and she said, you find one out there that's working a good 12-step program, and we'll bring him into this relationship. And I happened to pick the one she had been married to forever. And so Jim and Fran have been my guides and my mentors. He's past delegate in AA. And so I've had the best of both worlds, you see. God knew just how sick I was. And he sent me the best of AA and the best of Al-Anon. And I've had that at my disposal for the last 19 years. What a gift. What a gift. The last thing that I would do tonight, that I would tell you that I do tonight, is I take those 12 spiritual principles. And I do my best to implement them in my life on a daily basis. And I get up each morning, and I'm not one of those that's disciplined enough to get up at 5:30 and get the cup of coffee and go sit out on the deck with the birds and the squirrels and do the read. It's okay for those folks who can do that. I just can't. God and I talk in the shower. And we talk riding down the road. And that's the kind of relationship that I have with God today. But I start each day with asking God into my life and asking Him to take control of my life. And then my job is to go out there and put one foot in front of the other and be the best bow I can be. And some days I just do darn good with that. Especially when I'm at things like this. This is an easy place to do it, ain't it? Where's it tough? Out yonder. Out yonder, you know. In that airport tomorrow when the plane's delayed and the lines are long and the tempers are short and on the freeway when you get cut out, you know. Some days, I might not be real spiritual for 20 or 30 seconds. But what I know today is that it's not necessary that I be perfect. It's necessary that I be out there on the firing line. And I be doing the absolute best that I can do on a daily basis. And these are the things I do today in order to tell you I'm a member of Al-Anon. Let me tell you a little bit about me right quick. And to do that, I have to start with this statement. I was born at a very early age. Now, it's necessary that I go back there because I was born down there in not too far from where I live now. It's just south of Birmingham, Alabama, in the middle of something called a Bible Belt. And I was born into a very strict, very religious Southern Baptist home. Now, I don't know how spiritual we was, but let me tell you, folks, I don't know how spiritual we was, but we was religious. Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night, buddy, we was in that Southern Baptist church. Well, nobody's shaking their head. They got them out there in Texas, too, at the end. Lord have mercy. And what, you know, this went on up through my late teens till I left home. But what's important is, and at this time, is that it was in that Southern Baptist church there in Hueytown, Alabama, that I formed a concept of God that I brought into adulthood that caused me some trouble. Now, this is not the church's fault. I remember them teaching about God being loving and God being forgiving. But for some reason, the concept I brought into adulthood was I had a very judging and a very punishing God. You know the deal, you don't have to do it, just think it and you're guilty and God's gonna get you. And this was my concept of God when I found the doors of Al-Anon. Was a very judging and a very punishing God. Now, I wasn't raised around alcohol, around any drinking, so I didn't know anything a whole lot about drinking. Got involved in sports when I was in high school wasn't into drinking. And I met Shirley and we started dating. Shirley comes from the total opposite background. She comes from that broken alcoholic home. And she didn't drink for that reason. But the deal is she didn't drink. So I didn't drink, she didn't drink, and we dated for 5 years and wasn't any drinking. We finally decided we could get along, and we set the date, and we got married at that Baptist church out there in Hueytown, Alabama, and we set out on this thing called a Great American Dream. All we knew about life was chasing a dollar, and we thought we knew everything. We knew that successful people worked hard and made lots of money and bought lots of nice stuff. And the more stuff you had and the whiter your picket fence was, the more successful you were. And that's what we wanted to be. And we had both had good jobs and we're working hard and it took us a year to save up enough money for that down payment on that first home. And we bought that rascal and we was off and running. 3.5 years after we was married, God gave us the most beautiful blonde-headed, blue-eyed baby boy that a daddy could ever want. And old Mike became a part of the Great American Dream. 17 months later, along came the most beautiful brown-headed, brown-eyed baby girl. and Sissy became a part of the great American dream. And we sat down and took stock. We had two kids, we had two cars, we had two jobs, we had a house. Everything we had was mortgaged to the hilt, and we was happy chasing that dollar. Shirley went back to work, and she was asked to join this social sorority there in Bessemer, and she did. And it was at one of these sorority dances, parties, at one of the people's river homes on the Warrior River, right out of Hueytown there in Alabama. This was late summer, 90, 95 degrees, gets hot down there, gets real humid. And we're down there at these people's river house, and it's a beautiful, beautiful summer night. And then the lawn is just manicured, and the lights are down low, and live band, and the music is soft, and the moon is reflecting off of that river, and everything was just right. And I handed my wife the first drink of alcohol she ever had. I said, "Here, honey, drink this." And it wasn't but a few years down the road, she was right up in my face, and she was shaking her finger, and she was saying things like, "Bo, if you had never given me that drink, I wouldn't be the way I am today. And we wouldn't be the way we are today." And you see, I didn't know anything about alcoholism, and I didn't know what was going on. And all I knew was that mine and Shirley's relationship was changing, and not for the better. I knew that my relationship with kids was changing, and it wasn't getting better. I knew that our financial situation was changing, and it certainly wasn't getting any better. And all I knew to do was accept that guilt. And I took on a load of guilt that was to grow heavier and heavier and heavier until I found the doors of Al-Anon. Now, I could stand up here for three or four more hours and share war stories with you about our trip through active alcoholism. But we just don't have time for those war stories tonight. And I've learned something about those war stories over the past few years anyhow. What I've learned is that my war stories and your war stories are the same. Pretty much the same. All the times are different and the places are different, and maybe the circumstance might be a little different. But the thing that's the same is the pain. That's what war stories are about. They're about the pain. And the pain is the same. What I'd like to do is share with you a few of the pains that I experienced as we made our way through active alcoholism. And the first pain is that pain of guilt that I've told you about that was to grow stronger and stronger and get heavier and heavier until I found you. The next pain I share with you is a pain called anger. Now, I don't know about you, but let me tell you about me. On a good day, I got up angry and went to bed angry. And on a bad day, I got up angry and I went to bed in a blind, running rage. And toward the end of the drinking, if you had set me down, I probably couldn't even have told you who I was angry at or what I was angry about. And the sad part about it was, folks, that in my mind, I knew this wasn't right. I wasn't raised that way. But I also knew that everything that was happening in my life at that time seemed to be a legitimate cause for anger. The next pain I share with you is a pain called resentment. And I didn't know about resentments till I got to Al-Anon and you taught me what they were. But as I look back, I realize I was living my life full of resentment. Because you see, the time had come in my life now that if you lived up the street from me and I saw you and your wife and kids out in the yard cooking out or cutting grass or washing the car or doing something together, I resented you. Because alcoholism had robbed us of that. We didn't do things together anymore. If I saw you and your kids and your wife and kids get in your car and come by my house going somewhere together, I resented you. Because alcoholism had robbed us of that, and we didn't do things together as a family anymore. And of course, when you went by my house, if your car was nicer than mine, I certainly resented you. Because alcoholism had taken the nice things, and we didn't have them anymore. And of course, the biggest resentment by far is I resented God. What kind of God are you that will continue to punish me this way? All I did was put a drink in her hand. And I've got to continue to live in this pain, in this punishment. What kind of a God are you that would punish me that way this long? And once again, I remind you, this was my relationship with God. A very judging and a very punishing God And God was holding me, in my mind, was holding me responsible and was punishing me through Shirley's drinking. The next pain I share with you is a pain that I hear alcoholics talk about a lot. And it's a pain called loneliness and isolation. And I believe you when you say yours is a disease of loneliness and isolation. All I want you to know is you ain't got a corner on that market. I know about loneliness and isolation, too, and it has very little to do with how many people are in the room. Some of the loneliest times of my life have been in crowded rooms, surrounded by friends, and they would be sitting there, and they would be joking and cutting up and laughing, and their laughter would be genuine. And I'm sitting there, and I've got that old fixed grin, you know, that one we used to have that hurt our teeth? You know, and inside I'm saying, how can you be so happy? If you had a drunk wife like me at home, you wouldn't be that happy. And I would want to cry out to you, and I'd want to say, can you tell me something to try that I haven't tried? But of course, right before I did that, the red flag went up. Dummy. You don't say that to anybody, because if you admit that, then you've got to deal with that other pain that's eating your lunch. And that's a pain called failure. Because you see, I'm the Southern dad. And I'm the head of the family. And I'm supposed to be able to fix anything that comes along. And I hadn't been able to fix my wife. And so I sat there in a crowded room surrounded by you. And I stuffed it. And that's a very lonely, very isolated place to be. This is the way I was living my life in July of 1982. The kids were now teenagers. Mike was 15. Sissy was 13. We were four individuals living four separate lives out there in that little old house in Hueytown. In a house completely torn apart by a disease that we didn't even know existed. And we had the curtains pulled and we didn't let you in. And we had that great unwritten rule that every alcoholic home has. And that rule is you don't talk about it. And what you had to do at our place is right before you left that house, you stopped at that front door. And you made sure everything was in place, including that old false smile. And you hit the street out there and you told the world, we're fine, thank you. Yet we're dying inside, dying from a disease that we didn't even know we had. Late July 1982, the kids and I are going to one more softball game. And once again, we haven't asked Shirley to go. And that was okay with Shirley, you see, she was a kitchen drinker. And she didn't want to go. She wanted us to go. Because we would be gone 3 or 4 or 5 hours and she could do what she needed to do without us interfering. So Sissy and I are in the car and we're sitting there in the driveway waiting on Mike, and he's running a little bit behind. Mike's, like I say, 15 years old, about a half a head taller than his mom. Mike gets to the front door, stops. He and his mom have a little conversation, and then Mike comes on and gets in the car and we leave. It was sometime later that I found out what was said there, but I need to let you in on it right now. And I have Shirley's permission to share this with you. What Mike said to her that night when he got to the door, he said, Mom, when we get home tonight, you're going to be passed out on the couch or passed out on the floor. We're going to have to step over you. Where are you going to be passed out, Mom? Because you see, that was her deal. She would start drinking and then she couldn't stop, and she would drink until she passed out. And if Shirley was here with you tonight, she would share that for the very first time in Mike's life, she raised her hand to slap his teeth out. How dare him speak to her that way? And as she raised her hand to slap her son's teeth out, the picture flashed through her mind of the last time that her drunken daddy had beat her with a belt buckle end of a belt. And she had screamed out to her dad, and she said, Dad, if God ever allows me to have kids, I'll never lay a hand on them. And here she was with her hand raised to slap her son, and she couldn't deny that drinking had something to do with it because she had a glass of wine in his hand. And Mike didn't wait, and the slap didn't have to happen. And he came on and got in the car. We got home that night. I knew something was different when I pulled in the driveway because the front door was open. And Shirley was up. She wasn't passed out. And it was well past her passing out time. I got in the house and she had been drinking, but she wasn't drunk. And she met me at the door and she said, "Bo, I can't go on this way anymore, and I've called a treatment center and I'm going to go do something about my drinking." And I looked at her and I reacted today just exactly like I know I was supposed to, with all the sarcasm I could muster. I looked at her and I said, "Shirley, this is number 1,382. What's different this time?" Told her I didn't believe her and took a shower and went to bed. And it was the next day when that treatment center called me for information, insurance information, that I even believed her. Now, let me tell you, folks, God was directing our lives right then, and God, I would have told you, God didn't know where we lived. But you see, God sent us to a treatment center about 40 miles out of Birmingham that believes wholeheartedly in treating this thing as a family disease. It believes wholeheartedly in the 12-step programs of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. And there was programs in our area that didn't treat it that way, and we didn't know the difference. And God sent us where we needed to be for just a short period of time, where we could come out of there and turn the corner into your arms, where we've been ever since. I wish I had time to share with you some of the many, many things that, just little bitty things that happened, you know. One of the things that happened up there in the treatment deal is they had a thing called Family Week. And me and both kids went up there and moved in that place and lived up there from Monday to Friday. Now, they call it Family Week. I call it Hell Week. Because that's what it was. But you see, that's up there in Family Week. Let me tell you what the very first session was about. The very first session when we got there was about the disease of alcoholism. And about how if it's a disease, I didn't cause it. And that man even told me that day, he said, "If you're going to go to Al-Anon, you're going to learn about the three C's. The three C's being you didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it." I knew I couldn't control it and cure it. I needed to hear I didn't cause it, because you know what I took up there with me? I took that load of guilt. And it was right there that I started the process that, of course, I finished in Al-Anon, of letting go of that load of guilt. What I've learned the last 19 years in Al-Anon is that since I'm not responsible for my wife having that disease, I no longer need to try to be responsible for her recovery from that disease. And that's allowed me in Al-Anon, with a lot of loving arms and a lot of good sponsorship, to learn about detaching and letting go of my wife and letting her recovery be between her and the God of her understanding. And let me tell you something, you won't get around a recovering AA gal that's got a God of her understanding meet my wife. I'm telling you. But something real strange happened. When I learned how to let go of her, it freed up a whole lot of precious time and energy for me to spend on me. Yeah. Next thing that happened up there is important is we had a lady come up there and hold an Al-Anon meeting for us. Yeah. Doing that work, carrying that message. And it was 5 or 6 years later before I ran into that lady again. And I walked into an Al-Anon meeting one night, and there she was, and I went over to her. I said, "I'll never forget you." I said, "You were my first one. Most beautiful blonde-headed gal with the most beautiful radiant smile you've ever seen. Long, old-timer in Al-Anon." And she came there that night, and she did what old-timers do. You see, she brought me a message of hope, and she gave me good, orderly direction. She didn't give me any options that night, and I didn't need options in my life then, and I don't need options today. And thank God I've got old-time sponsors that don't give me options. They give me directions. When I'm in trouble, they give me directions. Thank God for them. So she told me that night. She said, "If your wife's going to stay sober, she's going to go to AA, period. If you want to regain your sanity and begin to experience any serenity, then you're going to go to Al-Anon, period." She didn't say, "I hope you do," or "I'm here to encourage you to." She didn't even do the infamous, "Why don't you try a sixth meeting?" No, she shook her finger and said, "Big boy, if you want what we got," she said, "you'll go to these meetings because that's where it is." Yeah. And then she threw the kicker in. She said, "By the way, if you're going to be any kind of daddy at all, you're going to make sure those two precious children are introduced to Alateen." Well, guess where the oldest, strongest Alateen group in the state of Alabama was at that time? Bessemer, Alabama. Already in place right there where we were going. Yeah. So me and the kids dodged bullets and got out of Hell Week. Waited on Shirley and picked her up Labor Day weekend, like I told you about, and off to Tuscaloosa we went. We were instructed that day when we picked her up to go straight to the Bessemer AA Al-Anon group. And they have their own meeting place there in Bessemer. And we would meet up with some folks there, and we were going to become part of a convoy. We used to convoy a lot. We don't convoy anymore. We're too busy. And I won't tell you about that convoy that night. Now, this is Labor Day weekend, and it's hot. It's a late summer, and it's hot in Alabama. And we get down there to the... Now, of course, it grows, you know, as the story goes. I'm up to about 80 vehicles now, I believe it was. That was in that convoy. They was pickup trucks, Suburbans, station wagons, two doors, four doors, sports cars, motorcycles, you name it, taxi cab. And not a one of them, not a one of them had an air conditioner that would work. We had 80 cars and enough people for 90 cars. So here we are with arms hanging out and, you know, and all that. And down the road to Tuscaloosa we go for our introduction to you and to this way of life. And then me and Shirley and the kids came back home that night, and we sat down that night. We got home a little after midnight, and she had been at that treatment center for 38 days. This was her first night home. And when we got home that night, the kids had bought her a 2-pound bag of chocolate chip cookies because they didn't have them at the treatment center. And we had bought a gallon of milk. And at 12:30 in the morning, that we sat down, the four of us, in that house there on 28th Avenue in Hewittown. We sat down in the middle of the den floor. And we started talking about y'all. And we started talking about what we had seen down there at that anniversary. And we made a conscious commitment and a decision that night to give this thing our best shot. And that's led so far to me being right here. But let me tell you the most beautiful, beautiful part of that night is that we sat there and we talked till the sun came up. And how do I know we talked till the sun came up? Because the curtains were open. And the front door was open. And you were no longer shut out. And you've not been shut out since that night. Man, what a deal. What a deal. Shirley gets over in AA. She gets her a sponsor. She's working 12 steps. She's getting well. She's growing spiritually. Serious about her recovery. I'm bouncing around over in Al-Anon, occupying chair, taking up spaces, and I'm getting worse. And for 7 months, that went on. And then finally the time came that I got asked Fran to be my sponsor, and we got started on this spiritual journey that I'm still on today. And Fran got me into the steps, and then Jim got involved in it. And they're both just so knowledgeable and so full of love and know how to convey. And I'm just growing by leaps and bounds, and I start to try to do an inventory. And I didn't tell them. I guess I was going to surprise them. I don't know. And I start having trouble, and so I go by there one day, and I says, you know, I'm trying to write an inventory, and I'm having trouble. And Fran looks at me, and she says, well, Bo, if you're trying to do an inventory, you've got to be in trouble. I said, Fran, where do you get all this wisdom? 30 seconds ago, you knew nothing about this. She said, well, son, if you're trying to do the fourth step, you're in trouble because you ain't through with the third step. She said, until you do something about your concept of God, you're not going to make much more progress. So my AA buddy Jim got up from the kitchen table and took me, literally took me by the hand, said, come with me. And he took me into his den. And he sat down at the desk in his den, and I sat down at the chair there at the desk. And he got out the textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous. And he took me into the chapter to the agnostic. And it was right there in his study that day with his direction that I found the God that I have in my life today. And that's a God of infinite power and of infinite love. Never-ending power and never-ending love available to me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I got it right out of the chapter to the agnostic in the textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous. Available to all of us. Right there. So I've got this new concept of God, and I said, man, I'm going to be off and running now. This thing's going to go wild. Well, I was off and running because I was running from God. Because, you see, now I knew that I was reestablishing this relationship with God, and I knew that God was going to have something for me to do. And I did not want to be a song director. I did not want to be a Sunday school director, and I certainly did not want to be a missionary. And so I continued to run from God. And finally, God just let me run and run and run till I ran out of rope. And I got up one Wednesday morning and I walked in the kitchen and I looked at Shirley and I said, I don't want to go to work. She said, okay, stay home. I said, I don't want to stay home. She said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to get away from me. I don't like me. I'm miserable in my own skin and I don't know what to do about it. I finally decided I'd go to work. I could be miserable there and get paid for it. And I tried to get to work that Wednesday morning, but I couldn't quite make it. 8:05 that morning, I pulled my truck out of traffic. And I sat there on the side of the busiest street in Bessemer, Alabama, and I beat on the steering wheel, and I hollered at God. And I said, God, I don't know what I've got that you can use, and I don't know where we got to go to use it. I don't know what we got to do. But whatever I've got and wherever we got to go and whatever we got to do, let's go, God. I surrender. And I gave it up. And I quit fighting God. And spiritual things started happening in my life. I realized tonight that what I did at 8:05 that morning is I fired Bo as the general manager of Bo's life. And then I looked around and I hired the best general manager that's available, and that's God. And my biggest job in my life today is to keep Bo fired and God hired. And as long as we keep it in that sequence, we do all right. So now the kids are going to Alateen. Sissy just fell in love with Alateen. She was 13 years old when she went in there. Next week, Sissy will be 33 years old. And she's got 19 and a half years of Alateen in Illinois. And she does something real strange every Tuesday night. She drives 25 miles back to Bessemer, and she sponsors that Alateen group that she was raised in. Yeah. Mike didn't like it. Said he wouldn't. He said, oh, I'll go to the convention, especially when y'all go to the beach. But he said, I just can't go to those meetings. That's okay. But Mike lived a 12-step program in his life. And the only way I know to explain that to you is if you live in a home where there's active alcoholism, you're going to be affected. If you live in a home where spiritual principles are practiced, you're going to be affected. So we're off and we're running, and then things begin to happen in our life, and it's not always the broad highway. And there's a couple of little tragedies that's happened, and I'm going to tell you about them real quick because I'm running out of time. But I need to tell you about them not because of the tragedy. I need to tell you so I can tell you the part that you played in it. You see, how you've always been there. And the first big tragedy that happened in our life was May 17th, 1988. We're 5.5 years into this program, and Mike, our 20-year-old son, is killed by a drunk driver. And I remember those three policemen opened the door there at midnight, and we looked at three policemen who had to tell us that one of them had been his little league coach. And my God, he was a mess. The policeman was. And then they brought us the news. And I remember that within 45 minutes of us getting the news of Mike's death, AA and Al-Anon was in our home. And you came there and you did something totally different. You see, the rest of the other family came, got tired and had to go home. The church came, bought that fried chicken. They left. AA and Al-Anon came and you stayed. And when you came in the door, you looked at us and said, whoa, we're not here to explain this. We don't have the answer. We're here because we know you're in pain, and we got open arms, and we got big hearts, and we got soft shoulders. And if you'll let us, we want to put our arms around you and love you through this thing. And you did it. You did it. The female AA, the female gals, recovering gals at the Bessemer group got together and made up a schedule of 3-hour shifts, 24 hours a day. Every 3 hours, there was a new gal showed up. She had one thing to do. Don't let her out of your sight and don't let her do anything she shouldn't do. Yeah. The Alateens. Mike was killed at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night. 9 o'clock on Wednesday night, 15 Alateens sitting in our front yard, Indian-legged with their arms around each other's shoulders with a circle of love with our daughter in the center of that circle. And I swear to you, I don't know where you get anything like that except in rooms like this full of folks just like us. It's the only place I know that you get it. I had the shotgun loaded and I was fixing to go get some revenge on a drunk driver. But you see, I couldn't get away with it because one of you recognized it. And you didn't ask me, are you planning this? You walked up to me and asked me, where's the gun? Give me the shotgun. Yeah. And I didn't have to do something very selfish and very stupid. Yeah. And you stayed right with us through that period and you made decisions for us that we weren't capable of making. And you see, we didn't come here for that. We came here to learn how to not drink. And look what we got. Look what we got. I want to share this with you. If I ever had any doubts about the power, the spiritual power that's generated when we gather in rooms like this full of folks just like us, those doubts were put to rest as I watched my wife walk through the tribulation of losing her son that way. And she didn't have to take a drink. And at that point, any doubts I had about Alcoholics Anonymous were put to rest. It's powerful, powerful medicine. Let me tell you, folks, there's a power here that my mind is not capable of comprehending. It's just not capable of comprehending. Thank God for AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. I'm convinced that I've walked the deepest, darkest valley that I'll ever have to walk in my life. For a daddy to lose his son and lose him that way, it's the deepest, darkest valley I'll ever. If something were to happen to Sissy and I were to lose her, it would be just as deep and just as dark, but it wouldn't be any deeper. The good news that I share with you tonight is I've never taken a walk through that valley alone. I've never taken a step of that journey alone. I've always had you on this side and God on this side. And we've made that walk. Yeah. When I walked up to my son's casket, I was able to say goodbye to my son. Because, you see, the damage had been repaired and we were okay. All the amends had been made and me and that boy was all right. We was okay. So we kind of get on the other side of that. Sissy falls in love. Decides to get married. Her knight in shining armor does not come into her life riding the great white steed. He came in riding the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's all right because we love Bob dearly. Bob had almost 5 years of good, big book, 12 step sobriety. Bob had been married before, had 2 children from a previous marriage. They wanted to get married in that same Baptist church out there. Said, if it worked for you and Shirley, it'll work for us. So we went out there that weekend for that marriage, and we had a counselor in Family Week who was a retired Methodist minister. And Howard said, I want to marry him. So we had a Methodist minister wearing a Catholic robe that he got somewhere. doing a Methodist service in a Baptist church. I've still got a resentment at my wife today because she would not let me pass the basket. Sissy and Bob get married. Shirley and I sell the big house. We bought 2 acres. We're land barons now. We bought 2 acres out in West Blockton, Alabama. That's just out in the middle of the woods is all it is. Told Bob and Sissy we was moving to the woods, and they said, not without us. And we were wise enough to know that we couldn't all live in one house. So we pooled all we had and we cleared off that 2 acres and put me and Shirley a house up on top of the hill and Bob Sissy a house down at the bottom of the hill. We got two beagles. They're looking for an Allopup group. Life's getting back on an even keel a little bit. And then in June of 99, our daughter calls us and says, I've got an aneurysm in my brain. We knew that she'd been having some migraine headaches and had been being treated for them, and the pain changed, and the doctor decided to do an MRI, and there was an aneurysm there. And the only treatment for an aneurysm, folks, is brain surgery. You know, the God deal about it is that we found it. We found it. So Sissy sets out on this quest to find her brain surgeon. I am an absolute wreck. Shirley, just as calm as could be, she kept looking at me and saying, Bo, it's going to be okay. Sissy, she's going to walk through this. And I'm a basket case. Because you see, when I found out about that aneurysm, you know where I had my daughter? In that casket. But I had a problem this time. You see, there was an amend that I still needed to make to my daughter that I hadn't been able to find a way to make. And it wouldn't be like Mike. One thing left undone, and I hadn't been able to find a way to make it. And that amend that I had not been able to find a way to make was, how do you make an amend to your grown daughter for not taking her to church and giving her the opportunity to have a God as a child? I didn't do that. She didn't know anything about God until she got to Alateen. So I'm a basket case. She finds a brain surgeon, says, Dad, come with me and go talk to the brain surgeon. She thought that was what had me upset, was the surgery itself. We go up there and we walk in that doctor's office, and there's a plaque on his wall, and the plaque says, this medical practice believes in spiritual healing. If you do not adhere to these principles, we suggest you find another doctor. Yeah. We found the only brain surgeon in the state of Alabama that didn't think he was God. Textbook surgery. You know why? Y'all were there. And the prayers were being lifted up all over this country. Yeah. Operated on her on Tuesday morning, sent her home on Saturday morning. Walked into her room on Saturday morning and said, pack your bags and get out of my hospital. She said, what are you talking about? He said, you're well. He said, there's nothing else that me or this hospital can do for you. You just need to go home and heal. He said, God has taken care of this and sent her home. She's fine today, 2.5 years later. Just doing great. So this past January, when they did the MRI on my back, and my personal physician, who is also 10 years recovering in this program, my personal physician looks at me and says, Bo, you got to go see a neurosurgeon. Nothing I can do for your back. You got to go see a neurosurgeon. And with a twinkle in his eye, he said, I think I know who you might want to go see. And I didn't have to go out on a hunt. I knew who was going to operate on me. Yeah. And let me tell you something, folks. The last thing that I remember before they put me to sleep that morning was there was a group of folks around my bed, holding hands, and we was praying. My family had just left, and we held hands and said the serenity prayer. And then the surgery team came in, and we held hands, and Dr. Morris invited God into that surgery. And I woke up that afternoon, and the pain was gone. And I came here 19 and a half years ago for you to tell me how to get my wife sober. What a deal. What a deal. I can't live my life on any kind of positive plane today without you. I must have you. That's how important you are to me. I can't do this thing alone. I know that. And today I don't even try. I must have you. And as I've told you a little bit about our family and our travels through this thing, I hope you have gotten the understanding of just how important you are in our lives. I will take a little bit of each and every one of you with me because I will take the power. And let me tell you, there's a power in this room tonight. Don't you ever forget it. And I'll take some of that power home with me. And I will be much better for being here. And I couldn't have done that unless you had been here with me. So when I was up here 5, 6, 7 years ago, ever how long it was, I made a deal with some of you folks as I closed my talk. And by us being here together tonight, I learned one more time that the deal works. So I'm going to close tonight one more time by making this deal with each and every one of you in this room. Here's the deal. I'm going to keep coming back. Rooms like this full of folks just like you. Now, your part of the deal is I want you to keep coming back. Rooms like this full of folks just like us. Now, if I keep coming back and you keep coming back, then one day, just maybe one day somewhere down the road, our paths will cross again as we trudge this road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.